It's Thursday, May 22nd, and it's 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, artists, and normal staff and normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the normal daily audio stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. Visit www.redaphid.com. Hey, welcome back, everyone, to the Daily Audio Stash. I'm Radical Russ. Hey, don't forget to get on the phone and call your Congress at 202-224-3121. Tell your representative to support Ron Paul's H.R. 5842, the bill to end DEA raids in medical marijuana states, and Barney Frank's H.R. 5843, the bill to end federal penalties for personal possession of marijuana. I know I keep saying it, but when you make these calls to your elected officials, it does make a difference. They treat a phone call very seriously because not a lot of people call. So make your voice heard. Call 202-224-3121. Today on the Daily Audio Stash, we're traveling across the pond to speak with Stephen Rolls, the research director of the Transform Drug Policy Foundation in London, England. We're talking about the recent reclassification of cannabis from Class C back up to Class B and the overall UK reefer madness obsession with the dreaded skunk. For our musical break today, Cannabis Carry brings us some smooth, funky jazz from Yamasaki with a song he calls Herbal Remedy. Then we'll finish up with Ryan Davidson from the Liberty Lobby of Idaho. Ryan's the man behind three initiatives passed in Haley, Idaho that legalize medical marijuana and industrial hemp and direct police to treat cannabis law enforcement as the lowest priority. You'll hear about the latest crazy twist in this story coming up in our hemp headlines. We're also playing Pass the Stash. You could win a free autographed DVD of the movie Totally Baked. Keep listening for details. We've got a lot to cover, so sit back and relax with a meeting of your joint subcommittee and enjoy your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Haley City Attorney to defend pot initiatives he opposed. Well, leave it to my birth state to bring us the latest in the altered reality we call reefer madness. A trial where the defense and the prosecution both want the same outcome, in order to ignore the will of the voters. From the Idaho Mountain Express. An anti-marijuana lawsuit filed earlier this month puts Haley City Attorney Ned Williamson in the ironic position of having to defend three controversial pot initiatives that he has staunchly opposed. Williamson told the Idaho Mountain Express in February, quote, "I will do my best to defend those laws," end quote, shortly after Haley Mayor Rick Davis announced that the lawsuit would be filed. Williamson was then asked if defending the marijuana initiatives would be difficult for him. He said again, quote, "I will do my best to defend those laws," end quote. Excuse me, isn't this like the old Western where the victims beaten by the railroad owner's thugs find out that the sheriff is in the pocket of the railroad owner too? The lawsuit, filed by Haley attorney Keith Rourke on behalf of Davis, City Councilman Don Kiern, and Haley Police Chief Jeff Gunter, seeks to have the obviously illegal pro-pot initiatives officially ruled illegal in Blaine County 5th District Court. The three initiatives, one to legalize medical use of marijuana, a second to legalize use of industrial hemp, and a third to make enforcement of marijuana laws the lowest priority for Haley Police Department, were approved by Haley's electorate last November. Hey, good job with the journalistic neutrality there. Obviously illegal, huh? It might be a tough case to make for medical marijuana and industrial hemp, but lowest priority isn't that clear. Lowest priority doesn't make pot legal in any way. It doesn't change the crime or the punishment for marijuana. It is just a prioritization of limited municipal resources. But that's beside the point. If they were obviously illegal, we wouldn't be going to trial. Please join us here at Normal and donate to the Rachel Morningstar Hoffman Foundation. Rachel Hoffman had just graduated from Florida State University with plans to attend culinary school. As an undergrad, she was popular among her group of friends, many of whom she had met through her involvement in Florida State University's chapters of Students for Sensible Drug Policy and the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Like many college students, she shared marijuana with her friends and would often go in on larger amounts in order to save money, and that's how she got busted. Rachel was threatened with prison time, then promised a slap on the wrist if she agreed to wear a wire and set up a deal with her suppliers. Tallahassee police gave her $13,000 in cash and told her to purchase 1,500 ecstasy pills, 2 ounces of cocaine, and a handgun. They never informed her attorney, family, or the state prosecutor before they sent Rachel into the lion's den that day, and nobody had the chance to tell her she was in way over her head. After police found Rachel's body, they held a press conference and blamed her for her own death. Among Rachel's family and friends, sadness quickly turned into outrage and action. Last Wednesday, hundreds of students marched in protest of the role the Tallahassee Police Department played in Rachel's death. They held signs that read, "Who Killed Rachel?" and "No More Drug War," while wearing t-shirts from SSDP and other allied organizations.
We want justice! We want truth!
A lot of people feel that Rachel died because of TPD's actions.
Urging police to take responsibility for Rachel Hoffman's murder, more than 100 protesters marched at the Capitol, many of them friends of the slain woman. Angry she was even asked to be an informant, they say the process was botched from the beginning.
We feel that TPD did a very poor job of handling this. They didn't inform her attorney, they didn't inform her family, they didn't fill out any paperwork.
Hoffman became an informant after being arrested on drug charges, but friends say police intimidated her into doing it.
In her memory, Rachel's parents have established the Rachel Morningstar Foundation, the goal of which is to pass a law requiring legal advice to be sought before a civilian can consent to undercover work. They will also work to decriminalize marijuana in Florida. Please visit our site at stash.normal.org so that you can find the links and make a generous donation to the foundation today, and include a personal note to Rachel's parents if you are moved to do so. In the meantime, Rachel's murderers must be brought to justice, but the drug dealers who pulled the trigger clearly aren't the only ones responsible for her death. They are the police who coerced her into being an informant and the politicians who justify waging a war on drugs to, quote, protect young people from drugs, while using those very same young people as pawns in their deadly game. On Wednesday, one protester's sign poignantly asked, "Do you feel safe?" New Jersey lawmaker considering legalizing marijuana for some residents. From the Daily Journal, Trenton, New Jersey. Patients suffering from cancer, AIDS, multiple sclerosis, and other life-threatening illnesses would be allowed to use marijuana to alleviate their symptoms under a measure to be considered today by New Jersey lawmakers. The Compassionate Use Medical Marijuana Act is scheduled to be debated before an assembly health panel. 12 states already allow the use of medical marijuana for chronically ill patients. The measure would permit certain patients to register with the Department of Health and Human Services to legally possess and use the drug, which has been shown to relieve nausea from chemotherapy, muscle spasms, and chronic pain, and to reverse appetite loss. The bill's sponsor, Reed Gusciora, a Democrat from Mercer, said, quote, "It does not make any sense for many of New Jersey's citizens to suffer when there is a viable way to ease their pain," end quote. Gusciora said there is no evidence of increased drug use in the dozen states that already allow for medical marijuana. The New Jersey bill enjoys bipartisan sponsorship. Republican Assemblyman Michael Patrick Carroll of Morris County said it is key for doctors to be permitted to use their judgment. Carroll asked, quote, "If you can go to your doctor and get a derivative of the poppy to treat pain, why can't you get a derivative of the cannabis plant to treat your symptoms? If a doctor using his or her best medical judgment thinks marijuana is the best thing for the patient, he or she should be allowed to recommend it," end quote. Medical marijuana bills have been introduced in New Jersey before, but have failed to advance. However, a Senate health panel heard from television personality Montel Williams and other advocates 2 years ago during an information session. Williams, a registered medical marijuana user in California, said he turned to marijuana to relieve debilitating knee and foot pain after trying OxyContin and a variety of other drugs to no avail. The bill now pending would allow patients to use marijuana medicinally by smoking it, eating it, or taking it as tablets prescribed by a doctor. The amount of marijuana a patient could possess would be capped at 1 ounce, and patients would be issued cards identifying them as registered medical marijuana users. Medical marijuana bills have been introduced this year in Alabama, Kansas, Illinois, New Jersey, and Ohio, and have been debated in Minnesota and New York as well. There is a medical marijuana citizen initiative on the ballot in Michigan. One or more of these states is set to be the first outside the West and the Northeast to enact medical marijuana protection under state law.
Marijuana is an addictive drug which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
Barbara Kay on the new marijuana, not your mother's reefer. Yeah, it looks like the UK reefer madness has now spread to Canada. This one's an editorial from Canada's National Post.
The words intoxicate the brain bring to mind the Post's 2007 editorial on marijuana, enunciated in response to evidence that Canada's marijuana consumption was the highest in the industrialized world. Quote, "What is really remarkable about Canada's status as a cannabis capital is that if you were to set out looking for reasons to worry about it, you would have an awfully hard time finding them. Legalizing pot makes sense," end quote. What was the editorial board smoking when these words were written? In fact, one would not have an awfully hard time finding reasons to worry if one were actually open to finding them. In 1997, the liberal UK paper, The Independent, launched a campaign to decriminalize marijuana. Since then, skunk, as Britons call the hybrid form of cannabis in current usage, has offered users a 25-fold increase in tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, cannabis's psychoactive ingredient. The mental and physical effects of this chemical change have been dramatic. In March 2007, The Lancet, Britain's leading medical journal, declared cannabis to be more dangerous and addictive than LSD and ecstasy. About the same time, Professor Colin Blakemore, chief of the Medical Research Council, and in 1997, the moral authority behind the independence liberalization campaign, unequivocally reversed his cannabis friendliness. Quote, "The link between cannabis and psychosis is quite clear now. It wasn't 10 years ago," end quote. As a result, The Independent last year offered its readership a fulsome apology. Quote, "If only we had known then what we can reveal today," end quote. Psychiatry professor Robin Murray of London's Institute of Psychiatry estimates that cannabis usage is causally linked to a full 10% of the UK's 250,000 bipolar patients. Indeed, just this past February, the European Respiratory Journal reported on a New Zealand study indicating that long-term cannabis use increases the annual risk of lung cancer in young adults by 8% for every year of use. In 1970, pot contained 1% THC. Bud contains 20% THC. Imagine a glass of wine or beer with a similarly proportioned alcohol content and consider the rush it would provide. 2 weeks ago, the Home Office in the UK announced cannabis will be reclassified as a Class B drug, sending a strong message that the drug is harmful. The verdict on the new marijuana is in, and it's guilty. I would therefore respectfully ask the Post to reconsider its editorial stance on the legalization of pot, clearly a superannuated description of cannabis today, and in future commentary on this issue, so critical to our youth's health, exercise a little more intellectual sobriety.
Oh, intellectual sobriety, huh? How about instead a few facts, please? Number one, skunk is 25 times more powerful? Where can I find some? The 1% THC 1970s pot cited would be called unsmokable industrial hemp and give you more of a headache than a high. I'd assume Canada's pot potency is similar to what has been measured in the United States, from an average of 3% THC in 1985 to 8% THC in 2005, according to the government's own statistics. This not-your-father's pot myth is created by comparing the pot tested years later from the hot, dry evidence lockers where it had been stored since the 70s, and the THC is degraded to the hemp-level 1% THC, versus the highest grade and rare hash and sensimilia that can range from 15% to 30% THC. You know, it's kind of a bit like saying alcohol is so much more dangerous today because dad drank 3-2 beer in the 70s and today there's Bacardi 151. Number two, cannabis more dangerous than LSD and ecstasy? LSD, the most potent psychedelic known to man, and ecstasy, a stimulant that has led to numerous deaths, more dangerous than the herb that has killed zero people in history? Really? Number three, the link between cannabis and psychosis is fabricated by UK scaremongers. Studies purporting this link have been extremely flawed, such as not controlling for poly drug use and failing to prove a causal link between cannabis and psychosis. I mean, many people already have psychosis and use cannabis to self-medicate. The latest research, published in the Journal of Human Psychopharmacology, finds very minimal risk psychologically from cannabis use. Number four, cannabis and bipolarity, or schizophrenia for that matter, is another one of these specious, correlative but not causal links. If indeed cannabis causes these massive harms, where are the bodies? As potency has risen, why has there been no associated rise in the incidence of schizophrenia, which seems to always hover at below 2% of the population? As cannabis use rates have risen and fallen, why haven't rates of bipolar disorder risen and fallen? Number five, lung cancer and head and neck cancers is not a risk of even heavy cannabis smoking, as shown by Dr. Donald Tashkin at the University of California, Los Angeles Medical Center. Number six, imagining the rush from beer or wine is not comparable. Alcohol intake requires 30 to 45 minutes of digestion before one feels the effects. Thus, someone unknowingly consuming a more potent alcohol does face a real risk of becoming drunker than intended. But with inhaled cannabis, the effects are known within seconds. This means no matter how potent the marijuana, a person smokes it to get high, and upon reaching the high, the smoker usually stops. In this way, more potent marijuana may actually be healthier, as the user would inhale less harmful smoke. And it should also be mentioned that users can vaporize or eat cannabis, which removes all the harmful effects of smoking. Furthermore, when talking about how terrible more potent cannabis is, we should remember that Canada has approved for medical use Marinol and Sativex, both synthetic versions of THC that are 100% pure. Strange that an easily grown weed at 15% THC is deadly skunk, but when the 100% THC is barcoded for profit, it's a recognized medicine. Number 7. Long-term cannabis use increases the annual risk of lung cancer in young adults by 8% for every year of use. So then after 12 and a half years of cannabis use, there's a 100% chance of getting lung cancer? The verdict on Ms. K's reporting on cannabis is in, and it's guilty of the same old reefer madness propaganda yellow journalists have fostered on an uninformed public since William Randolph Hearst back in the 1930s.
Marijuana is a shortcut to the insane asylum. Smoke marijuana cigarettes for a month, and what was once your brain will be nothing but a storehouse of horrid specters. Hashish makes a murderer who kills for the love of killing out of the mildest-mannered man who ever laughed at the idea that any habit could ever get him. End quote. William Randolph Hearst, 1936.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
We've been giving you a lot of stories here on the Daily Audio Stash about the United Kingdom and their reclassification of cannabis, and plus all the crazy reefer madness stories that we hear from out of there. And I thought we'd just go straight to the source. So I'm speaking today with Stephen Rolls in London, England. He's the research director for the Transform Drug Policy Foundation. Stephen, welcome to the Daily Audio Stash.
Hi there.
Well, I wanted to talk just a little bit first about this reclassification of cannabis. Give our listeners kind of just a brief background of the history of cannabis in England, specifically, you know, how it got downgraded and why they're trying to upgrade it.
Our main piece of legislation is the 1971 Misuse of Drugs Act. And in a similar way to the States, where you have, I think, 3 or 4 schedules that supposedly rank drugs according to how harmful they are, and then tie those rankings into a hierarchy of criminal penalties. We've got a similar system in the UK, but we have a 3-tiered system, which is an ABC system. A being the most harmful drugs, things like heroin and cocaine, but there's also some drugs including LSD and ecstasy, which are in there perhaps rather anomalously. Class B drugs include amphetamines. And Class C drugs is more the kind of prescription drugs which are diverted, things like steroids and Valium. And from 2004, it included cannabis. Around the year 2000, 2001, the debate around cannabis being perhaps misclassified began to gain some real mainstream traction. And the then Home Secretary, David Blunkett, made a decision, which he announced in 2001, that he was minded to reclassify cannabis down from Class B to Class C. And what that would mean was that for possession, at least, the most serious punishment you could get would drop from 5 years in prison to 2 years in prison. But in practice, it would mean that if you were found in possession of a small amount for personal use, you would probably be let off with a warning or a caution rather than a prosecution or a fine. And that actually happened in 2004. But what happened since then has been quite interesting, because the opposition parties and some of the more kind of evangelical anti-drugs groups have subsequently used the reclassification to attack the government, and to specifically attack the government's drug policy. So opposition to the government have basically tried to characterize it as a soft position, as a weak position, as a sort of position of surrender in the drugs war, of sending out the wrong message, of sending out the message that cannabis was harmless, of even of giving young people the green light to take cannabis, and so on. All the things that are rather familiar to people in drug policy law and law reform. And this kind of built up ahead of steam over the years following 2004, up until last year, when alongside a whole series of kind of reefer madness reporting, which very kind of very skewed towards trying to make cannabis look as bad as possible. We had a new Prime Minister. Tony Blair stepped down, very unpopular, and Gordon Brown, our new Prime Minister, took up the reins. And he was very clear to very keen, I think, to impose himself on the sort of public consciousness, in particular to appeal to a certain type of floating voter. We call them Middle Englanders, a kind of sort of conservatives, I guess, in the UK. And so what he wanted to do is to sort of assert his moral authority by drawing a line under several of the kind of contentious policy issues of that have been very high profile under Tony Blair. This included some stuff on gambling, some stuff on drink licensing, and the cannabis reclassification. So he then basically announced a series of U-turns. So really what it has subsequently come to pass, and cannabis was reclassified or is in the process of being reclassified sort of as we speak, back to Class B.
Yeah, that's such a shame. And let's look at the effects. Since cannabis was reclassified back in 2004 from Class B to Class C, was there an increase in cannabis smoking? Was there any harms associated with that downgrade in cannabis?
Well, I mean, it's quite controversial, actually. I mean, what's happened is from 1971, and you can go back further, but basically cannabis use has been rising pretty steadily for a number of decades. Particularly in the 90s, cannabis use was rising quite quickly. But then, interestingly, from about 2000-2001, it seemed to have peaked, and the statistics suggest that cannabis use was actually falling marginally year on year. And the reclassification in 2004 didn't seem to have any impact on that fall, which has actually continued. The conclusion to make is that not that the reclassification increased or decreased drug cannabis use, but that it was completely irrelevant and that cannabis users simply didn't care.
Gotcha. Now, was there any change in incarceration during those years? Were there less people arrested and jailed for cannabis?
Well, I mean, not really, because people generally were not jailed for cannabis anyway. It's not quite like it is in the States, where over here it's actually very rare for someone to be jailed for cannabis possession. It only really happens if it's a kind of parole violation, for example. So, certainly a first offence, or even not a first offence, jail is actually not really used. So. And as often happens, really, the reclassification was, in effect, kind of codifying what was already police practice. See, the police over here, like many police in the States, are actually quite pragmatic and have no real appetite for mass busts of cannabis users. They know full well it doesn't serve any useful purpose, and can actually just alienate young people from the police and so on. So there's no real appetite for doing that amongst the police anyway, and really the reclassification was just kind of translating into legislation what was already police practice. And it's interesting, actually, that since the reclassification back to Class B has been announced, the police have said that it's not actually going to change their day-to-day policing practice. So they will still have at their disposal the same options of a warning, a caution, or a prosecution. And I doubt very much that reclassification back to B will actually have a great deal of impact on the streets in terms of enforcement. I think the impact really is a symbolic political one rather than a practical one.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that it just seems like, you know, this is all just designed around Gordon Brown trying to distance himself from the legacy of Tony Blair.
I think that's a very fairly astute analysis. He's actually even less popular than Tony Blair is now.
Oh, wow.
for a number of reasons. I think that announcement, along with a whole series of other announcements, to be fair, but was very much aimed at appealing to a particular constituency of conservative voters who Brown felt he needed to get on side if he was going to see off the challenge from David Cameron and the Conservatives. That really isn't anything new in the world of drug policy.
Exactly. And one last thing here, Stephen, I wanted to talk just a little bit about the media there in the UK, specifically the tabloid media and their characterization of this. I mean, we hear this a little in the States. It's more like a brand name, you know, skunk, but over there in the UK, it's like the demon name for marijuana they've been using. How much of this reporting on the dreaded skunk is driven from the top down, from government and policy and politics, how much of it is the citizens of the UK, the subjects, I guess I should say subjects, desire for these kind of stories? I mean, these stories wouldn't sell if people weren't buying them.
Sure. I mean, skunk has become the concept of skunk, which is actually a very unscientific and ill-defined term. In America, I just guess you'd call it bud, or
yeah,
it's basically the hydroponically grown bud.
It's what we call good marijuana.
Yeah, and well, in the UK, there's basically been a classic, and I mean classic in terms of looking back at the history of drug policy over the last 100 years, a classic drug panic. You could look at some of the discourse on skunk from UK media over the last couple of years, and you could change the word skunk for cocaine or crack. So we've seen skunk and insanity, skunk and violence, skunk and infertility, skunk and kind of general moral deprivation, degradation, all the classic things. Now, none of them are entirely untrue. I mean, you can always find anecdotes that support those things. But what's happened is you've had this very one-sided reporting where once the snowball is sort of rolling, the journalists out there, they are specifically looking for negative stories about a drug. So anything that suggests anything to the contrary, that the drug isn't as harmful as some of these reports suggest, or that really anything that challenges the kind of prevalent myths isn't reported, and anything that backs them up gets headline coverage. And so what happens is you just have this sort of self-fueling series of myths. It's very difficult to argue for legal regulation of cannabis when people are suggesting that it drives young people into an early grave, or drives them to become axe murderers, or drives them into mental asylums.
Very, very well put. Well, Stephen Rolls from London, England. He's the research director for the Transform Drug Policy Foundation. Is there any websites or phone numbers, if we've got listeners out there on the continent or over there in Britain that would like to get involved? How can they get in touch with you guys?
Transform has a website. It's www.tdpf.org.uk. That's tdpf.org.uk. That's for Transform Drug Policy Foundation. We also have a blog, which is linked from the main site, which is popular and covers a lot, and has really covered this story in quite a lot of detail over the last couple of years. On our website and on our blog, you can find all our publications, all our discussion documents. And if you're interested in getting more involved, there's details about that too. And we would welcome anyone to come and check it out.
Excellent. Stephen, thank you for joining us here today on the Daily Audio Stash.
Now it's time to play Pass the Stash, where you can win cool prizes from Normal.
Okay, for our latest Pass the Stash contest, you could win the uncensored DVD of Totally Baked, written by Craig Shoemaker and autographed by the executive producer Brian Johnson, the lead singer of AC/DC. It's a hilarious story of two medical marijuana activists who hide out in the home of a straight-laced dad and take him and his debate team friends hostage. While the activists employ creative strategies to convince the squares on the truth about cannabis, a Rod Serling-esque narrator, Shoemaker, weaves us through commercials, stand-up, documentary interviews, and skits that are interspersed throughout the movie.
Hey! Who found the lawyer?
All you have to do to win your autographed copy is to send me an email at stash@normal.org. All I want to know is your funniest first-time pot-smoking story. Now, limit your story to 420 words or less and send it in now. This contest only lasts 2 weeks. The winner will be announced May 30th. By submitting a story, you agree to have it published on the Stash blog and read on the air, but we will be glad to change names and identifying details to keep you anonymous. So send in your funny 420 story today and win your autographed free copy of Totally Baked DVD. And thanks for playing Pass the Stash. Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take the time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Stressed out? In need of a lift? Today's Stash is a cure for what ails you in the form of Herbal Remedy by Yamasaki. It is smooth jazz dripping with funk. Yamasaki is the name used by writer, producer, and solo artist Tom Edwards. He is the new sound, the emerging jazz that is gliding over the path laid by greats such as Herbie Hancock and Stevie Wonder. Infusing influences like Fatboy Slim, Yamasaki takes his place as a force in the modern jazz movement. Herbal Remedy is just what the doctor ordered. Check out our website at stash.normal.org, where you can find the link to Yamasaki's MySpace page to hear more of his remarkable music. You can also get our link to podshow.com for more on the album, and also a download of the MP3 of this song. It's Yamasaki with Herbal Remedy.
Thank you. Hi, this is Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of Normal. We are the oldest, largest, and best-known marijuana law reform organization in America. And it's all because of your support. Take some time to join Normal at www.normal.org. Your membership supports this podcast, our websites, our policy research and analysis, and our annual conferences. Changing marijuana laws is a grassroots effort, and it starts with you, the stakeholder. Join Normal today and add your voice to the millions of cannabis consumers who demand equality with our beer-drinking friends.
All right, we're going back to my birth state of Idaho, and I'm speaking again with Ryan Davidson, the chairman of the Liberty Lobby of Idaho. And Ryan, welcome back to the Daily Audio Stash.
Hey, thanks for having me, Russ.
Yeah, we'd had you on before talking about the city of Haley, Idaho, up there near Sun Valley, and how you had passed 3 out of 4 of your initiatives. Let's remind our listeners what your initiatives, the initiatives that passed, what they were for up there in the city of Haley.
One was the lowest police priority initiative. One would legalize medical marijuana, and one was for industrial hemp.
Yeah, and so the latest strange development in this case has to do with the city officials there up in Haley, I guess suing the city of Haley to get these initiatives declared illegal. What's the strange kind of situation you're facing up there?
Well, the city officials, you know, the mayor and the council, they have wanted to get rid of these initiatives ever since they passed. Heck, they wanted to get rid of them even before they got on the ballot. But after the initiatives had passed, they debated ideas about repealing them or amending them to take out pretty much any provision of substance. I think they decided that it wouldn't be advisable politically to do so. Or legally, because once I knew that they were planning something like this, I took steps to put the initiatives back on the ballot. So all 4 original initiatives are back on the ballot for this upcoming May primary election. Once the city knew that I was going to put them back on the ballot, they decided against repealing them because they knew that they might just get voted back in. They decided to go to the courts. Well, you can't just, you know, go to the courts. You know, they had to, in an interesting roundabout way, file this lawsuit, because once the initiatives passed, they were the law of the city, and the city is obligated to, you know, enforce their own laws, to defend their own laws. Well, to get around that, the mayor, the city council, the mayor, the chief of police, and one city councilman, as private citizens, sued the city of Haley in order to get a declaratory judgment that the initiatives are in violation of law, as they pertain to their specific duties. So the lawsuit was filed about a week ago. And that's where we're at right now.
And so the situation that we're in now with the lawsuit being filed, this is these 3 city officials turning as private citizens suing the city of Haley. So the person in charge of defending the laws of the city of Haley is?
The Haley city attorney.
Which is the guy who was against the law in the first place.
Yeah, in fact, he was the chief critic of the initiatives throughout the campaign. And he was the one who obviously was advising the city council that they could repeal them or amend them into oblivion. In fact, he basically created a memo or a strategy on how all the initiatives were illegal or in violation of state law and how they could be repealed. So he's basically come up with a blueprint for someone to file a lawsuit on how the initiatives could be repealed or declared invalid by the court. So the question is, what kind of defense is he going to put on?
Right.
You know, the guy has said from the beginning that they're illegal, so how is he going to defend them in court? Well, he claims he'll put on the best defense he can, but frankly, I don't see much of a defense forthcoming. If he was able to come up with a defense for the initiatives, he would have done that from the very beginning.
Right. Yeah, this just seems so suspect to me, and I'm just wondering, you know, if there's any law or anything that would cause this guy to recuse himself from this case and maybe have someone else be the defense here. I just don't understand how this is even possible.
Well, I will most likely file as an intervener in the case, as a person with a real interest in the outcome of the lawsuit. And if I get intervener status, which I think is pretty likely, I will ask the court to bar the city attorney from defending these initiatives on conflict of interest grounds and to assign another attorney. Because frankly, I think it's just absurd that the chief critic of the initiatives is somehow going to be able to put on a viable defense.
Now, how do the city officials that are suing, how do they get standing to sue for this as private citizens? I was reading something about a claim that it would violate their free speech rights if they had to advocate for the change in cannabis laws. I mean, this also seems pretty convoluted.
Yeah, because all the initiatives had provisions in them that the city, the official position of the city, that marijuana should be legal and that the city should lobby other branches of government, such as the state legislature, for changes to the state law regarding marijuana. Well, the city officials say that that violates their free speech because it makes them take positions that they don't believe in. But the initiatives don't call for any individual city elected official or employee to specifically lobby. It says that it's the general position of the city that marijuana should be legal, and it doesn't say that the mayor or the chief of police have to lobby. It just says that representatives of the city, meaning that the city council could appoint somebody to lobby the legislature on the city's behalf.
Sure.
Now, I don't see how they can say that this violates their free speech because it doesn't directly apply specifically to them. It applies specifically to the city in general. And cities pass resolutions all the time. You know, the city of Haley, I believe, has passed an anti-nuclear waste resolution. I mean, if something like that were passed 3-4, could the fourth councilman sue and say that that violates his free speech?
Well, exactly. I don't think so. That's what I'm saying is that, you know, they're suing as private citizens, but nothing about this initiative forces them as private citizens to have one belief or another. And it's about the office. It's about the representation of the city, not a person's free speech rights. That seems quite specious to me. Another problem that was cited by the other side had to do with council members who might also have federal jobs, that they'd have to give up their federal jobs. What do you have to say about that idea?
Well, one council member is an employee of the Federal Forest Service, and because of pressure from her employer, she has recused herself from any discussion of these initiatives whatsoever because apparently the federal government's position is that we don't like legalized marijuana. And so we have an interesting situation where the federal government is able to put this serious pressure on an elected official to not even discuss an issue, which is just amazing to me. In fact, I think that's the violation of the First Amendment, because this council person won't discuss these initiatives for fear that she'll lose her job.
Yeah.
And she's not discussing them in her workplace, in the Forest Service. She's discussing them as an elected official in front of the city of Haley. And frankly, I think she's a bit of a coward for kowtowing to this. But I think that she feels that if the city goes ahead and enforces these initiatives and has to take an official position on it, then she'll have to give up her seat because of the federal pressure. Well, I say she should probably give up her federal job if she wants to be an effective council person.
Exactly. And finally, as far as defending these initiatives, we've got one initiative that legalizes medical use of marijuana, another one that legalizes industrial hemp, and Idaho law, the state of Idaho, clearly doesn't legalize that. So it might be a tough defense there. Let's focus on the lowest priority one for a moment. What would there be in Idaho law that would say that a city couldn't direct their police officers to use their resources in a certain manner?
I believe that the only defense that they're able to come up with it, and it's pretty technical and pretty lame, is that the initiative process in Idaho can only be used for legislation and not administration. And I believe that they're taking the position that telling a police department what to do is an administrative act and not a legislative act. So, you know, it's pretty lame on their part. And if that's the only defense that they have, I don't think that it's going to be successful. Courts have always said that it's a very thin line between what constitutes an administrative act and what constitutes a legislative act. And it's one of those real narrow, it could go either way type of things. But, as a result of the precedent I got in the Supreme Court, which allowed me to put these initiatives on the ballot, the court struck down the two cases in Idaho which said that you can't use the initiative process for administrative initiatives. Now, they struck them down on other grounds, but I think that it really indicates that the Supreme Court is taking a more pro-initiative stance than they have in previous years, and that it would probably apply to any other aspect of the initiative process. I think the Supreme Court wants, you know, initiative to go forward and not to be struck down on these little technical grounds. And I think that they will enlarge the definition of legislative as opposed to enlarging the definition of administrative when looking at this lawsuit here.
Well, we'll keep following up on that and find out how it turns out. You got one of the strangest stories I have to report on when the guy that is against your initiatives has to defend them. But that's
well,
Idaho.
Get stranger even still when you're looking at who's prosecuting the case. And frankly, what really offends me in this case is that even though the mayor and the chief of police and one councilman are suing as private citizens, they're entitled to use tax dollars to hire a private attorney to sue the city.
It's through the looking glass in Haley, Idaho, that's for sure. We'll definitely keep up on this and remind folks of the website so that they can get more information if they're in Idaho and want to know about this case.
It's IdahoLibertyLobby.org. And a lot of the new news stories are at the Idaho Mountain Express's website, which is the local paper. Just go to sunvalleycentral.com.
Excellent. Ryan Davidson, chairman of the Liberty Lobby of Idaho, thanks for joining us again on the Daily Audio Stash.
Thank you.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes, this one from Ronald Reagan, the former president, who said, quote, "Government exists to protect us from each other. Where government has gone beyond its limits is in deciding to protect us from ourselves," end quote. Unfortunately, President Reagan never took his own advice when it came to marijuana policy in the 1980s, feeling that it was necessary for the government to take care of us. But anyway, the sentiment is still a good one. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and interviews you can use for the cannabis community. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.